Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis. Welcome to Your Health, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Science Desk here at NPR. Today, we'll hear about efforts to get incoming college freshmen to submit their DNA to the dean, and why a scientific advisory panel said no to a diet drug, but yes to a diabetes drug this week.
But first, we've all experienced a little laryngitis. In this business, it can be pretty brutal. But how about Julie Tribal? She caught a cold last spring and lost her voice for 6 whole weeks. Tribal's cold turned into a rare condition in which the muscles that control the vocal cords lock up. But she was lucky. She found a doctor with an unorthodox method that solved her problem. Gretchen Kuda of member station WCPN in Cleveland has this report.
I met Julie Tribal at the Cleveland Clinic in mid-May. In that forced whisper, she tells me that 6 weeks earlier, she got laryngitis. At least that's what she thought. But Tribal hadn't been able to speak in her normal voice since then.
April 1st, I got a cold. And this part never got better.
Without her full voice, Tribal had to stop working her job at the meat counter of a local grocery store because she couldn't be understood by the customers. In fact, she says it affected pretty much every aspect of her life.
I can't talk on the phone. I can't order food at a restaurant because people don't understand me. My son had a hockey party and all the parents were sitting around and nobody talked to me. They just sat there. And I know it's because I can't talk back, but I really didn't feel a part of anything.
Scopes of her throat, CAT scans, an MRI, and visits to various specialists yielded no answers. But today, in the waiting room of the Cleveland Clinic Head and Neck Institute, she's hopeful that will change. She has an appointment to see Claudio Milstein, a voice specialist who's optimistic he can send Tribal home today, able to speak.
I'm going to try first some techniques where basically I'm going to be using my hands on your shoulders, your back, and your neck, okay? I am going to ask you to make some sounds while I work with you, but no speaking. Okay.
Dr. Milstein begins by manipulating the muscles in Tribal's throat with his fingers.
I'm going to stretch the muscles around your voice box. Those cracks, you hear that? Okay, those are normal, so don't be concerned.
She winces slightly as he presses against her voice box. He turns her head from side to side and then presses down on her shoulders.
So you lean forward, drop your head all the way down.
To the casual observer, it looks something like a chair massage.
Okay, we're going to start working with your voice now. I'm going to have you make a sound like E without strain. Okay, so long E's.
E.
Chin down a little bit. Keep going, long
E.
He continues to work, massaging her shoulders, neck, and throat. And within minutes, the raspy whisper begins to disappear.
Lean forward, shoulder up, drop your head. Go ahead, one, one, really loud.
One, 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 one.
There's your voice. Again.
One, 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 one.
Louder.
One, 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 one.
One, two, three, four, five.
One, two, three, four, five.
There's your voice. Say, hello, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
You can talk now.
I can talk now.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Does that sound pretty much like your normal voice?
Just about.
Milstein says Tribal's condition, something called functional dysphonia, is caused when the muscles that control the vocal cords tighten up and lock. It took him just under 7 minutes to release them and allow her to speak again.
In order to produce voice, you need to have a very good balance of muscle tone in a lot of different muscles that are involved in voice production. So an intervention like this, where basically you manipulate those muscles and try to restore that internal balance, is very effective.
The problem, it turns out, is fairly common. Milstein estimates he sees about 10 patients like Julie Tribal every month.
Sometimes these patients have been without a voice up to 2 to 3 years.
One reason for this, he says, is that things like cancer, infection, acid reflux, and neurological problems need to be ruled out first. And that may involve multiple doctors, medications, and expensive tests. Another is that it takes a speech pathologist to diagnose and treat the problem. Nelson Roy is a professor of speech-language pathology at the University of Utah.
If I look at the larynx and there might be a little bit of redness, but the patient sounds like this, you have to be able to say the inflammation that I'm seeing is insufficient to produce that kind of voice problem.
Roy says no one really understands the underlying cause of functional dysphonia, and that led many doctors to believe the disorder is psychological in nature.
These are complicated cases. You're really straddling that territory between mind and body. And that's the territory that medicine has a difficult time with.
Yet psychological and stress management therapies are rarely effective alone, says Roy, and are best combined with a hands-on treatment or therapy where the patient learns how to use their voice differently. There's plenty of clinical evidence showing that physical manipulations of the voice box and voice therapy can be extraordinarily effective, but few controlled studies have compared treatments or studied their long-term effectiveness. Milstein says that in his hands, most patients have a permanent recovery. He demonstrates a set of vocal exercises for tribal, but today she has just one piece of homework.
For the rest of the day today, you have to talk nonstop. Talk and talk and talk.
No problem, right?
No.
For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuda.
We just heard about what happens sometimes when you can't talk, but now we'll hear about a man who can't hear. Well, okay, he can definitely hear. He just can't figure out who's speaking to him on the phone. Believe it or not, it's a rare disorder called phone agnosia. Elise Spiegel has more.
As a boy growing up in Northern Virginia, Steve Royster was confronted with a small but persistent mystery, a mystery that presented itself every time he used the phone.
Everyone always knew when I was calling, just by the sound of my voice, while I had no earthly idea who was on the phone when they called.
Royster couldn't understand this. It made no sense. Really, there was only one possible explanation.
I thought I had such a distinctive voice that everyone could recognize me the second I spoke on the phone. That was the best I could come up with.
In fact, Royster had phone agnosia, or voice blindness, a very rare and very strange disorder. Like everyone else, phonognosics can tell from the sound of your voice if you're male or female, old or young, sarcastic, upset, happy. They just can't tell who you are.
Not that every voice sounds the same to me. It's just that hearing someone's voice doesn't bring that person to mind.
According to phonognosia researcher Diane Sittis, the part of the brain that allows people to distinguish things like age, gender, and emotional content in a voice is different from the part of the brain that makes sense of whether or not the voice they're hearing has personal relevance, the part that's able to determine when something is familiar. In phonognosia, that part of the brain is damaged, so if they can't see you, they can't place your voice. This is why Steve Royster never knows who's calling him, even when the voice on the other end of the line is his own mother.
Often at a loss, and I have to fake it.
So what do you do to fake it?
I just continue to say, well, that's nice, and eventually hit on something about the house or one of my brothers, and that will clue me in that this strange woman who has called me is, in fact, the one who gave birth to me.
Well, for some people, having phonognosia is genuinely difficult. Royster says for him, it falls into the category of minor annoyance. In fact, he didn't even know he had it until he was 27 and started sharing a small office with a coworker. Apparently, one of his bosses would frequently call him up and start barking orders without ever identifying himself, while Steve, who had no idea who it was, just sat there, flummoxed.
And after hearing my end of several of these conversations and my complaints after I would get off the phone that, well, why is this guy calling? He just said, well, you recognize his voice, don't you? I said, well, no, how could I?
But probably the worst moment caused by his phonognosia happened when Royster was a little bit older.
Someone called me on the phone, and I was trying to be what I thought was flirtatious with the woman I was then married to. And it was the wrong woman.
Since that conversation, Royster has suggested that people identify themselves up front. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
When you go to college, you might expect a few welcoming presents from your alma mater to be. A pen, a baseball cap, maybe even a notebook or two. But a DNA test? Some incoming freshmen at the University of California, Berkeley, will be offered voluntary DNA tests to analyze genes that help control the body's responses to alcohol, dairy products, and folic acid. NPR's Robert Siegel talks with Dr. Mark Schlissel. He's the dean of biological sciences at the college, about the plan.
First, what's the idea behind, as it's being called, bring your genes to Cal? Well, each year we look for an engaging topic of intellectual and social interest that calls upon the breadth of expertise in Berkeley, and we use it to welcome our students to our intellectual community. So last year, for example, we spoke about Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, speaking about sustainable agriculture and human nutrition. This year, the group of deans settled upon this topic of personalized medicine, the set of rapidly improving DNA-based technologies that will allow physicians to better prevent, diagnose, and treat disease. And the question was, what kind of study object should we send our students? But rather than send a book or an article, we came upon the idea of actually involving the students in providing a sample of the type they may be asked to provide by their physicians in the future. We thought it would be an engaging way to start the conversation.
And what are the three genetic markers that you're going to test Berkeley freshmen and transfer students for?
Yep. We purposefully chose three genes that are not disease-associated. So the first is a gene that codes for an enzyme called lactase, which is involved in digesting milk products, lactose, the sugar in milk. The second is a gene called methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase, or MTHFR for short, and it's involved in the metabolism of a vitamin, folic acid, vitamin B9, found in leafy green vegetables. About 40% of the population has one type of this gene, and 60% has a second, so it's a common gene variant. And the third is a gene called aldehyde dehydrogenase that's involved in the metabolism of alcohol. That's associated with a syndrome where folks take a drink of wine or beer and their face turns red. Facial flushing, it's called, and associated with a bit of nausea. Again, quite common in the population, not associated with a disease, just part of normal human variation.
The program has generated some controversy, and I wonder if you sympathize at all with people who instinctively think that asking for DNA is a little bit more intrusive than asking for, say, your Social Security number.
We certainly had this notion in mind as we designed the program. It was absolutely key that the program be entirely voluntary with no element of coercion. And that we assure the anonymity and privacy of these samples. And we designed a program which we believe does those things. And we also put it past our institutional review board, a committee called the Committee for Protection of Human Subjects that looks at all research on the Berkeley campus involving humans or human materials.
Do you know yet what the degree of compliance with the request is, whether almost everyone?
No, that's interesting. We have a bit of a pool going on here on campus. It depends who you ask, actually. It turns out folks my age or perhaps our age, I'm in my early 50s, wonder whether maybe 10, 20, 30% of the kids will comply. But I've spoken with groups of newly accepted students in my capacity as dean, going out and telling them what to expect about their freshman year. And uniformly, the kids seem to think this is a great idea, and I asked them how many people would respond, and they're guessing 90% or more.
Dr. Schlissel, thank you very much for talking with us about it.
Pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for your interest.
That's Dr. Mark Schlissel, who is Dean of Biological Science at the College of Letters and Science at UC Berkeley.
Some people say menthol cigarettes are more addictive than regular cigarettes, something about the flavor maybe. This week, advisors to the Food and Drug Administration expressed their concerns about what the industry does to make the product attractive, especially to young people and minorities. The FDA is considering a ban on menthol cigarettes, and Brenda Wilson has the story.
Scientists have wondered if the taste and characteristics of menthol don't enhance its appeal as a starter cigarette. Federal studies have shown that large numbers of young people seem to prefer certain brands such as Newport's or Marlboro. A vice president of Philip Morris USA, Jane Lewis, insists that the company doesn't target these groups, but says consumers are attracted by a combination of factors to menthol cigarettes.
Consumers tell us that they're cooling. They tell us there's a taste preference, and they tell us that they're cooling. And that all sort of kind of folds together, I think, into what they prefer with those cigarettes.
But when panelists suggested that menthol covers the harshness of tobacco and makes it harder to give up a harmful habit, the scientific director of Lorillard, the manufacturer of Newport's, William True, objected.
Absolutely not. The most significant items that impact the harsh taste of a cigarette are the tobacco blend, the moisture level of the blend, and the filter ventilation. Okay, our product developers do not use menthol in any way, shape, or form to try to cover up, mask, or minimize that harsh taste.
The studies show that the byproducts of nicotine rise more quickly in the blood in the first few minutes of smoking a menthol cigarette than with a regular cigarette. About a half hour later, there is no difference. And menthol smokers tend to smoke fewer cigarettes, which suggests that it takes fewer menthol cigarettes to achieve the same effect. But True says that doesn't mean the product is more harmful.
Internal studies do not indicate that menthol cigarettes are smoked any differently or more intensely than our non-menthol cigarettes. And these studies reinforce the overwhelming weight of epidemiology literature, which indicates that menthol and non-menthol cigarettes convey similar risks of chronic disease.
However, African Americans who have a higher rate of lung cancer mainly smoke menthols and mainly Lorillard's Newports. The company's marketing director, Leonard Jones, denied they target African Americans, although they do place ads in African American magazines. But he says most of their promotional activities are directed to retailers.
There's this misconception that we advertise or promote our products differently in different ethnic communities. That's not true. A state that indexes high for Newport development may be eligible for a higher rate of discount.
Jones says that means in states where excise taxes have increased the price of the cigarettes, Lorillard provides discount products to protect its share of the market. In the second round of testimony today, the FDA advisory panel will examine more closely the use of menthol by certain groups, why young people seem to gravitate to the product, and the effect of menthols on smokers who are trying to quit. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
There's been a whole lot of FDA news this week. Advisors to the agency heard 2 days of testimony about whether a popular diabetes drug increases the risk of death and decided that no, it doesn't. Another advisory panel said the FDA shouldn't approve a diet drug, Qnexa. Here to talk with us about that is Scott Hensley, who runs our health blog Shots. He's been blogging about this stuff all week. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So, Scott, let's start with that diabetes drug, Avandia. This drug's been out there for like 10 years. Millions of diabetics take it to control their blood sugar, and it does a pretty good job with that. So what's the problem now?
More than 3 years ago, questions started surfacing about whether Avandia raised heart risks for patients. There was lots of circumstantial evidence. People went and looked at old trials and sifted the data, and they said, you know what, there's an indication here that this drug may carry a special risk of increasing heart attacks and other kinds of problems in diabetics who are already at risk for that kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's been some increased risks shown up, but not enough to pull this drug off the market?
Well, that's what this hearing was all about. There's been more evidence that's come in the last 3 years since a panel last looked at this drug and said it's probably okay to leave it on the market. And I think people coming into this meeting were kind of betting, well, it looks like, you know, things are kind of going against the drug. But in the meantime, the company had been doing a trial to examine these risk issues a little bit more and use that evidence in its defense.
So if you're taking Avandia, then what should you do?
I think the panel was pretty clear in saying, look, this drug doesn't need to come off the market just yet, but it needs to be restricted in its use, and people need to pay a lot more attention to the potential risks. And so a patient who is considering a drug like this or who is on it should have a pretty careful, in-depth discussion with their doctor about whether it's worth it.
And another thing that happened this week had to do with Qnexa. You want to tell us about that? This is a promising new weight loss drug, right?
Yes. In fact, some of the same people who were advising the FDA on Avandia stayed over in Washington and considered this drug, which is a combination of two old medicines, one used primarily to treat epilepsy, and another drug, a stimulant that used to be part of the Fen-Phen diet cocktail, but it was the half that didn't cause heart problems. So this drug came up before the panel, and they rejected it.
Why? I mean, what were there more side effects with this than some of the other ones on the market, or?
Safety was the issue. I should say that the high doses of this drug led people who had taken it to lose and keep off about 10% of their weight up to a year after they had started the study. But there were problems that surfaced. One that affected a lot of people was increased heart rates. And then the thing that seemed to worry the panel the most was the risk of birth defects for women who conceived children while they were taking the medicine. And that was an area where I think they want to see more evidence on how big a risk that is and how it could be controlled. And that was a major thrust of the problems that the panel kind of had in thinking about this drug.
So when does FDA actually decide whether the drug's okay or not?
They have until the end of October. And so we should remind people that the FDA usually pays attention and follows the advice of these panels, but they don't always have to. The company says they've got some more data that may help put this hazard in perspective. And so we won't really know what's going to happen until probably sometime in October. The FDA could go ahead and approve it. But for something like this, when a panel of experts raises a real safety concern, that's a pretty high bar for the agency.
Speaking of safety concerns, let's talk about one of the more fun posts you had on the blog this week about high heels. Now, let me tell you, I know that they make your legs look sexier, but seriously, I can't wear them the whole day anymore without my legs hurting, my feet hurting. I go home, I have to put them in a bath. What was the blog post about?
April, you're not alone.
many women have feet.
these British researchers who study muscles and biomechanics have heard all of these complaints and decided, let's find out what's going on. And so they placed an ad in a newspaper and got women who were habitual high heel wearers to come in and participate in their study. And then they later recruited women who preferred flats to look at the differences. And bottom line, what they found was that women who wore high heels, high heels,
like 3 inches,
like more than 2 inches, I think was the number. They over time, the muscle fibers in their calves grew shorter. They became about 13% shorter.
And wow!
To compensate, so that they could still walk and all, they had a thickening of their Achilles tendons. And the real upshot of this was that for these women who were really hardcore high heel wearers, even when they took them off, they had pain when they stood flat-footed. And the problem there was that the Achilles tendon just wasn't stretching the way that it used to. So
I'm visualizing, since on the science side, we're doing a series on evolution. If evolution selects for women who wear high heels because they look sexier, are they ultimately going to turn into a species with thick Achilles and short calves?
Yes, and I think...
I'm sticking to my Converse one stars.
I think that's right. So we took the opportunity to talk to a bunch of other folks who have studied high heels or injuries from high heels about, well, what should women consider when doing this? And it's a lot of fun. So I recommend the post to people. And I think there's some good advice in there, too. One person says, if you're going to wear heels, keep them under 2 inches. A woman from the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto says, it doesn't matter what the science is. High heels are not about how something feels. It's how it looks. And the symbol that a high heel gives a woman is a symbol of sexuality and also a privilege in a way that you don't have to be physically active or physically able. You can strut around on your high heels and not worry about sensible flats.
I think the thing to do, April, is just to bronze a pair and wear them around our necks.
That works for me. I'm sticking to sneakers. Well, thanks, Scott.
Yeah, Scott, thank you. Oh, and where, if we want to find this post, should we look?
On NPR's health blog called Shots.
And thank you very much for listening to another special podcast brought to you by April and Scott and me.
That about wraps it up for Your Health. I'm April Fulton.
I'm Rebecca Davis. We'll be back next week.